Thank you very much to the organizers for the invitation. It's my great pleasure to be here. And yes, as Theo said, I would like to, since, I mean, given the background of the audience is really, really mixed up, I mean, I would like to give you a gentle introduction to one particular tool I use in my research, which is categories. And I would like to spark your curiosity for these guys, and because it can be really, I think they can be really useful for mathematical research in mathematical physics. I am more on the mathematical side of things. Please bear with me on this, although I have a physics background and I like to play with both worlds. But yeah, back to categories. I would like to start mentioning that, I mean, these mathematical entities rise on the research of Samuel Eilenberg and Saunders MacLane back in 1945 in a very different context than the one I'm mentioning here. And I could say this in my own words, but I think somebody said it better. And so why should we consider these guys? I'm going to quote Emily Rule's category theory in context, the preface. Why should we think about categories? Well, a category is a context for the study of a particular class of mathematical objects. But actually, these mathematical objects, groups, modules, rings, whatever, classifying them, this is not the main point of categories. Rather, the action of packaging each variety of these objects into a category shifts one perspective from, you know, the particularities and technicalities of each mathematical subdiscipline to potential commonalities in it. In other words, I mean, using categories, we see the internal symmetries, internal structures, rather than just the technical little details of our field. And this helps us comparing these different structures in different settings. Actually, this is a very practical idea for mathematical physics. And my favorite example of this is homological mirror symmetry. Because in this case, I'm talking about the statement of Concewicz. What we're doing here is just comparing, you know, strings in two, I mean, in the A model and in the B model, but through categories. For those that know what I'm talking about, strangulated categories. On one side, we compare categories of something called sheaves, coherent sheaves on some Calabi-Yau's. On the other hand, we're comparing Foucaille categories, I mean, in particular, Lagrangian submanifolds in this, in these categories. And I mean, these two things, these two mathematical notions in the A model and the B model, they are really different. But if you have a look at the categories, you see how to match them together, making this, I think, a good case of why we should consider categories all around. All right, so why don't we go into a little bit of detail? And let me start giving you maybe the only precise definition I'm going to give today. I'm going to pave my way slowly to model a tensor categories, but let's just keep it simple and go for a category. What do I mean by this? A category consists of mainly two ingredients. First, a collection of objects. By collection, I'm being sloppy here, but there's a reason for this. I'm going to mention it later. Collection of objects in the previous cases of mirror symmetry, coherent sheaves, or if you want something simple, finite dimensional metaspaces over a field K. Just take as many as you want. And a collection of morphisms between any of these two objects. So this is one first requirement we want. So that every morphism has a specified domain and codomain object. So you really don't go out of this set of, or this collection of objects, you stay in this collection of objects, jumping with morphisms from one to the other. You're also gonna need that for every object in your category, you want something like the identity. So some morphism from this object to itself that really does nothing. And you want to also compose morphisms. So for example, if you think of vector spaces for your objects and morphisms, linear transformations between them, you want a way of composing your linear transformations, one with each other. So you want, I mean, for any pair of morphisms, you want a certain composition that makes you jump from one object to the next one, and from this one to the final one. And of course, I mean, you want all this structure to satisfy certain axioms that ensures that everything works well. The first one is default is some kind of associativity condition. If you give me three morphisms, what I'm going to request is that if I first compose these two and then a third one, this has to be the same as if I first compose the first one and then these two, or just compose three of them. This is this associativity condition. And second, I would like to ensure that this identity morphism behaves well in the following way. I want to ensure that if I first compose with the identity morphism and then jump from one object to the other, this is the same as if I jump and then act with identity morphism. As I said, I'm being a little bit sloppy on what I mean by collection of objects. In collection, I can take a class or the set, but I mean, one needs to be a little bit careful in here. One may find Russell's paradox, by the way. Russell, he was born and died in Wales, where I met, which is very a matter of pride for me. But you have to be careful with this, what you take, because you may incur into some paradoxes. I mean, this is a more theoretical thing. And for another field that I would like to go into later. Okay, in order to help you digest this, and let me give you some examples of how you can think of categories. So easiest example you can think of is the sets, easy. In here, your objects, they're going to be simply sets in general, and morphisms can be functions between them. If you prefer to think of vector spaces because they appear more often in your work, well, just take vector spaces over a set in field K and as your objects, and as your morphisms, just consider linear transformations as I was explaining before when I was giving the definition. If you want to go like a little bit more algebraic, well, you can always consider GRP, which is the category where your objects are groups. And if you want, by the way, you can refer only to abelian groups in a subcategory called AP. And your morphisms are going to be group homomorphisms. So for example, I mean, think of for the composition, you know, I mean, if you can compose group homomorphisms, well, this is with your composition, identity, it's clear, and so on. But that, I mean, because I have a preference for algebraic examples, this doesn't mean this is the only case you can have. You can have more geometric ones, and also other playbooks. Here's just a couple of examples. The first one is a category of smooth manifolds with smooth maps between them, topological spaces with continuous functions between them, also metric spaces with short maps, or as I mentioned before, from the homological mirror symmetry, you can have categories of sheaves, of coherent sheaves, you can have categories of it, well, so as many examples as you want. The thing is, if you have two mathematical objects and you know a way of of jumping from one to the other, there's a chance you can construct a category. And actually, if you want to like explode this concept like a little bit more, you can also construct things like categories of categories, which is where the set theoretical problems kind of arise. So this is when making a choice between class or set makes a difference. It's kind of one of the things one needs to take into account when you go into something called higher category theory, when you construct this higher. But actually, constructing categories of categories, although it has some applications in mathematical physics, very interesting ones, I would like to go a little bit more into, let's say, the internal side of categories. What kind of, instead of creating like very high structures, I would like to go more into what's the internal structure that one can have in a category. And for this, I mean, all the time, what we want to do is mimicking like the algebraic behavior we have before in representation theory of groups or whatever. And so Let me walk you through some of the structures that are desirable in this context, some examples, sorry, and take the example of vector spaces to guide you through. So if we want to mimic something like the tensor product of two vector spaces over a field, okay, I mean, this behavior is kind of mimicked by something called monoidal category. In these categories, you have a tensor product plus some extra morphisms that ensure that this tensor product is well-defined. If you have something resembling, I mean, you have duals for every object that you have in your category, just as you will have for vector spaces, then you will have the notion of rigid category. If you have some very nice behavior, which is that whenever you consider the set or class of morphisms between two objects in your category, if this conforms a K-vector space, this is what it's, by the way, roughly speaking, called a K-linear category. I mean, for the sake of clarity, I'm being super superficial. I'm skipping a lot of technical details, but if you're curious, please let me know. Warning there. And if these so-called Hammett spaces, these spaces between of this sets or class of morphisms between any two given objects that conform a vector space, if this vector space is a finite dimension, this is what we call a locally finite category. Of course, I mean, with vector spaces, you can define the notion of kernel, of a co-kernel. I mean, this is mimicked by the notion of abelian category. And if you sum all this structure together, plus a little bit more of details, for example, that my field K, I mean, this is something called a simple object. This means that we cannot break in pieces, in smaller pieces, these objects. Condition one, condition two, I have finitely many of symbols in my category. So there's a finite collection of objects in my category that cannot be divided any further or broke or subdivided in any way, up to isomorphism, of course. And the third one is that I can express every object in my category in terms of this set of simple objects. If I have all of the previous structure plus this one, this is the notion of fusion category, which is a very interesting notion that actually appears in topological computation and quite a lot of other topics. But I would like to focus in a particular example of fusion categories, which is called the modular tensor categories. In addition to all of the previous structure, I need to include some extra more if I want to have a modular tensor category, which is, roughly speaking, again, I need to include a braiding. This is some morphism that goes between the tensor product of two objects to the tensor product of, let's say, the crossed of two objects. So you can think of this in a, let's say, I mean, in a Pictionary way as this morphism. So if you have here the tensor product of these two objects and you go to the tensor product of these two objects, then you go from x to x and y to x this way. And of course, I mean, every time in category theory, you add some extra structure. I mean, you need to ensure that all this new structure is compatible with all of the previous structure you have been having before. So for example, this is expressed in terms of conditions like this. Similarly, we need something called a twist. And it's really like twisting around. I cannot do this because I have a cable in here. But I mean, this is just a morphism of x to x that can be represented. It's a little bit more complicated to explain, but just if you think about it in the Pictionary, this can be written down as this twist. And again, it needs to satisfy a certain condition that shows that this extra structure is compatible with all the previous. Here you see, I mean, for example, I mean, in here, you see that this is some braiding. So what you're checking more or less is that if you take, I mean, there's some compatibility between this and this, these two structures. And finally, you need to have something called S matrix that you can construct from composing the braiding in this way. And you need to see that this is a test of how nice the braiding is defined in this case. In the Pictionary, this is related to the Hopf link, for those of you more link-oriented, and that's it. So, I mean, it's a lot of packed information, but I mean, it's a rough idea of everything, all the structures you need in order to have a modular tensor category. Let me give you a couple of examples on this. One is the so-called Fibonacci category. You only have two objects. This is the multiplication table. In Fibonacci, it's because actually all these categorical data, a lot of the categorical data I just told you about can be described, depends on actually a golden ratio, which is something really cool. But going into a more physics inspired example, I can tell you about the so-called Ising category, which is actually inspired by the critical limit of the Ising model in two dimensions, which is actually a so-called two-dimensional conformal field theory, rational. And it has three objects that multiply in this way. And speaking of examples related to CFT, so here is like my absolute love forever and ever, and the coolest example you can ever have of a modular tensor category. Whenever you consider a conformal field theory and you go into, have a look at the algebras of chiral symmetry, that appear in the world identities, these algebras in here, they are actually mathematically formalized as something which is called vertex superior algebra. This was a notion invented by Richard Borchers back in 86. He coined the notion of vertex algebra. And Frank M. Lerman and Napolsky 2 years later introduced the real notion of vertex operator algebra, which is actually a little bit more close to the physics. And just mentioning that this guy won because of inventing this thing and applications to some other problem, the Fields Medal in 98. And how are these related? It's when, for me, the magic completely happens. With modular tensor categories, it's that there's this theorem by Heiji Huang that that actually proves that if you consider these VOAs and construct something which is called a representation of this VOA, if it's a VOA nice enough, and actually for the CFTs, normally they are, this is actually a modular tensor category. So it's two different worlds. At least to me, a little bit complicated mathematical structure, but it has this beautiful categorical incarnation that actually gives you a lot of tools to understand a little bit more using categories, your CFTs, which is where most of my work has gone on. I may take three more minutes here. That works? Great. So once you have a more mathematical business, well, what do you do if you have your MTCs? Learning about these MTCs, if you want to classify them, this is like a widely open problem. This is a mission where, there's like many people involved, but I really would like to mention Julia Plavnik, who actually is attending this conference. Talk to her, she's amazing. She's my hero completely. This is a photo of us back in 2013 in Hamburg. And they have come up with a classification of up to six objects, more or less. So like, as you can imagine, there's way many things to do. And of course, we have evidence from the physics and the mathematics literature of many more. I'm mentioning here there's a database made by Gannon, Hahn, and Yamauchi on, let's say, almost every case that we know. Correct me, Theo, if I'm wrong. And of course, if you want to classify, there's a bunch of tools you can do. And there's actually a bunch of invariants you can assign to MTCs. And if you do, this is actually also a brave new world that still hasn't been, the last word hasn't been said so far. But of course, I also would like to mention of attendance of the conference, Colleen Delaney, he's also involved, and Julia have been involved in studying how these invariants, I mean, can be used and if they are complete, and how, if we have a set of invariants, if they are complete and tell everything we need about the MTCs and not. Something I have been doing for some years now is actually trying to build some bridges between conformal field theory using these categorical structures. And I have been doing this connecting with something called Landau-Ginzburg models. If you're curious, talk to me. I can rant on this for ages. And of course, I mean, one can go a little bit even beyond, more internal into the categories and look for some nice structures, like, for example, algebras, which in the case of rational CFTs, full rational CFTs describe boundary conditions. So for example, this is something I'm exploring with a PhD student, and something I explored with an amazing team from the WINRT, the Women in Representation Theory group, in not exactly MTCs, in something slightly more general, something called group theoretical. And beyond, I mean, of course, this is not the only, I mentioned CFTs, but this is actually not the only place where they arise in mathematical physics. They also appear in the classification of three-dimensional TFTs and more places. So if you're curious, please ask us, let us know. And for this, I think I will finish. Thank you very much for your attention. And forgive my voice. I'm having a cold.
Thank you for the wonderful talk, Anna. We will open the floor to questions, and there was one in the chat.
Sorry, I couldn't see that.
Sujama asks, she said, question for later, is the twist some sort of idempotent spin morphism?
Idempotent spin morphism.
I'm just trying to understand, like, I've seen the other types of morphisms, and I'm understanding what a braid is, I know what the cups and the caps are. How should I be thinking about the twist, is I guess what I'm trying to ask.
Okay, so I mean, what the way I think of the twist, it's in a way like, how does this, I mean, for in order to define the twist, you need to define duals, I mean, to your associated to your object, I mean, the left, okay, right module. And then what you see in here is like, what happens to your object if you compose, I mean, you kind of make arise a dual and kind of collapse it back again. So as I see as a way of testing what happens whenever you consider that you play with it, the dual of your object. Mm-hmm. I can give you an example. In conformal field theory, suppose that you have the minimum model, like, mm-hmm, very simple. I mean, the twist associated to these guys can be expressed as the identity times some factor, where this factor is an exponential depending on the conformal weight. And that's it. So it's, I mean, for me, some kind of measure of, if you just have identity, I mean, whenever, mm-hmm, you act, I mean, with the duals, or you just have something else. And I mean, that's the way I think about it. I don't know if that helps.
I can follow up with you later. I think pictures will be useful, but yeah, sorry.
Yep.
I didn't mean to distract, to get too much in the weeds.
Okay. Christina, do you think you have a question?
Thank you very much for the talk. I learned a lot of things.
Well, thank you.
I didn't know anything when you start your talk, so that, thank you. I have a question. At a certain point, you are talking about braiding. And this brought to my mind the problem of anions and trans-Simons theory, in which you are braiding.
Yes.
Your braiding connected with this?
Yeah, I mean, in...
Yes, what is the bridge to arrive to this trans-Simons theory? And can you have it non-abelian?
Okay, so from the very, very little I know from anions, and forgive me, SBT. I mean, I think that they were talking about the same thing. Normally what you need to use it for these topological anions are braided fusion categories. So it's just what I had on my first slide. Well, actually, I'm still sharing, so I'm going to go there. So you have all this structure, and the only extra ingredient from this is like until here that you need to consider. And in this case, what you're requiring, whenever you want to model topological onions, you can, the way you braid them, like you exchange these guys, it's the same way as this should go. If I remember fine, which...
This is exactly what I'm asking, because these things, this monoidal tensor category, I use by then to classify topological order, symmetry protected topological order. So that's why I wanted to see if there is an easy way to see the link from this to the topological field theory that described this type of thing. That was my...
Mm-hmm. I mean, whenever you want to mimic the behavior, I mean, if what I just as a summary, I mean, whenever you want to mimic the behavior of the onions in your theory, it just works like this. You will have here two onions and how you braid them. I mean, by the way, this is not the only condition. There's like a bunch more. So you have, for example, one of the things you need in the monoidal tensor category, I mean, to prove that this is braided, is something called the hexagon axiom. So if you have...
It again, I didn't understand.
So, I think that in these cases, what it's being used is exactly this structure. I don't know exactly if it helps, but I mean, there's a bunch of extra conditions that you need to consider in here. For the braiding, I mean, this is like one, but there's more. And one of them is something called the braiding. The hexagon axiom, which is like checking that the braiding is compatible with the structure of the monoidal tensor category. Well, sorry, of the monoidal category, not modular tensor category, monoidal category. But I think it's the same thing. What I don't know exactly is just the specifics, but the structure is just right there. It's the same one.
Thank you.
Yep. Fidine?
Hi. Yes, thank you very much for the very nice talk. I was wondering, because 2D CFTs are in some kind very special, but is there a way to use these modular tensor categories for higher dimensional CFTs as well? Or?
Great question. I actually don't know. And this should be some kind of correspondence in the same flavor as 4D, 2D. But I'm not completely sure, like what's the actual mathematical structure lying behind. I mean, just to mention a little bit, what's the actual status? I mean, whenever we have a rational CFT, I mean, we know that actually this is the categorical structure to have in there. But for example, if you go into the non-rational cases, there is one requirement, which is semi-simplicity, namely this one. And that having finitely many symbols that just blows in the air. And it's not completely clear how for things like this, the S matrix should be generalized into that case, or how can we classify them in general, like when you drop semi-simplicity, how this behaves and so on and so forth. So yeah, no idea. Actually, I'm pretty curious because there has been quite some progress on this lately. On the more BOA side, and I'm just so looking forward to see what's coming. It should be super cool.
Okay, thanks.
Are there any other final questions? If not, let's thank Anna again for the excellent talk.
Thank you.